Chapter 2.
And they walked again in the bright cold, even though it was noon now and about as warm as it would ever get today, probably, back across the creek bridge and, suddenly, looking around, they had gone almost a half mile along the creek and he didn't even remember it. The dog put a rabbit into a briar patch beside a cotton field and, yapping hysterically, hoiked it out again. The small, frantic, tawny-colored blob looking one instant spherical and close-coupled as a croquet ball, and the next one long as a snake, bursting out of the thicket ahead of the dog, the small white flare of its scut zigzagging across the skeleton cotton rows like the sail of a toy boat on a windy pond, while across the thicket Alexander yelled, "Shoot him! Shoot him!" Then, "Why don't you shoot him?" And then he turned without haste and walked steadily to the creek and drew the 4 coins from his pocket and threw them out into the water. And sleepless in bed that night, he knew that the food had been not just the best Lucas had to offer, but all he had to offer. He had gone out there this morning as the guest not of Edmund's, but of old Carruthers McCaslin's plantation, and Lucas knew it when he didn't, and so Lucas had beat him. Stood straddled in front of the hearth and without even moving his clasped hands from behind his back, had taken his own 70 cents and beat him with them. And writhing with impotent fury, he was already thinking of the man whom he had never seen but once, and that only 12 hours ago, as within the next year he was to learn every white man in that whole section of the country had been thinking about him for years. We got to make him be a nigger first. He's got to admit he's a nigger. Then maybe we will accept him as he seems to intend to be accepted. Because he began at once to learn a good deal more about Lucas. He didn't hear it. He learned it. All that anyone who knew that part of the country could tell him about the Negro who said ma'am to women just as any white man did, and who said sir and mister to you if you were white, but who you knew was thinking neither, and he knew you knew it, but was not even waiting, daring you to make the next move because he didn't even care. For instance, this. It was a Saturday afternoon 3 years ago at the Crossroads store 4 miles from Edmund's place, where at some time during Saturday afternoon, every tenant and renter and freeholder, white or black, in the neighborhood would at least pass and usually stop, quite often even to buy something. The saddled, trace-galled mules and horses tied among the willows and birches and sycamores in the trampled mud below the spring, and their riders overflowing the store itself out onto the dusty banquette in front, standing or squatting on their heels, drinking bottled soda pop and spitting tobacco, and rolling without hurry cigarettes and striking deliberate matches to smoked-out pipes. This day there were 3 youngish white men from the crew of a nearby sawmill, all a little drunk, one of whom had a reputation for brawling and violence, and Lucas came in the worn black broadcloth suit which he wore to town and on Sundays, and the worn fine hat and the heavy watch chain and the toothpick. And something happened. The story didn't say, or perhaps didn't even know what. Perhaps the way Lucas walked, entered speaking to no one, and went to the counter and made his purchase. It was a 5-cent carton of ginger snaps, and turned and tore the end from the carton, and removed the toothpick and put it into his breast pocket, and shook one of the ginger snaps into his palm and put it into his mouth. Or perhaps just nothing was enough. The white man on his feet suddenly saying something to Lucas, saying, "You goddamn biggity stiff-necked stinking burr-headed Edmund son of a bitch!" And Lucas chewed the ginger snap and swallowed, and the carton already tilted again over his other hand, turned his head quite slowly and looked at the white man a moment and then said, "I ain't a Edmunds. I don't belong to these new folks. I belongs to the old lot. I'm a McCaslin. Keep on walking around here with that look on your face, and what you'll be is crowbait," the white man said. For another moment, or at least a half one, Lucas looked at the white man with a calm, speculative detachment. Slowly, the carton in one of his hands tilted further until another ginger snap dropped into his other palm. Then, lifting the corner of his lip, he sucked an upper tooth. Quite loud in the abrupt silence, but with no implication whatever of either derision or rebuttal or even disagreement. With no implication of anything at all, but almost abstractedly, as a man eating ginger snaps in the middle of a 100-mile solitude would, if he did suck a tooth, and said, "Yes, I heard that idea before. And I notices that the folks that brings it up ain't even Edmonds's." Whereupon the white man, even as he sprang up, reached blindly back where on the counter behind him lay a half-dozen plow single trees and snatched one of them up and had already started the downswing when the son of the store's proprietor, himself a youngish active man, came either around or over the counter and grasped the other so that the single tree merely flew harmlessly across the aisle and crashed against the cold stove. Then another man was holding the man, too. "Get out of here, Lucas," the proprietor's son said over his shoulder. But still, Lucas didn't move. Quite calm, not even scornful, not even contemptuous, not even very alert. The gaudy carton still poised in his left hand and the small cake in the right, just watching while the proprietor's son and his companion held the foaming and cursing white man. "Get the hell out of here, you damn fool!" the proprietor's son shouted. And only then did Lucas move, without haste, turning without haste and going on toward the door, raising his right hand to his mouth so that as he went out the door they could see the steady thrust of his chewing. Because there was the half dollar. The actual sum was 70 cents, of course, and in 4 coins, but he had long since, during that first few fractions of a second, translated them into the 1 coin, 1 integer in mass and weight out of all proportion to its mere convertible value. There were times, in fact, when the capacity of his spirit for regret, or perhaps just simple writhing, or whatever it was, at last spent for a moment and even quiescent, he would tell himself, "At least I have the half dollar. At least I have something." Because now not only his mistake and its shame, but its protagonist, too. The man, the Negro, the room, the moment, the day itself, had annealed, vanished into the round, hard symbol of the coin, and he would seem to see himself lying, watching, regretless, and even peaceful, as day by day the coin swelled to its gigantic maximum, to hang fixed at last forever in the black vault of his anguish, like the last dead and waneless moon and himself, his own puny shadow gesticulant and tiny against it in frantic and vain eclipse. Frantic and vain, yet indefatigable too, because he would never stop. He could never give up now, who had debased not merely his manhood, but his whole race too. Each afternoon after school and all day Saturday, unless there was a ball game or he went hunting or there was something else he wanted or needed to do, he would go to his uncle's office where he would answer the telephone or run errands, all with some similitude of responsibility, even if not actually of necessity. At least it was an intimation of his willingness to carry some of his own weight. He had begun it when he was a child, when he could scarcely remember, out of that blind and absolute attachment to his mother's only brother, which he had never tried to reason about, and he had done it ever since. Later, at 15 and 16 and 17, he would think of the story of the boy and his pet calf, which he lifted over the pasture fence each day. Years passed, and they were a grown man and a bull, still being lifted over the pasture fence each day. He deserted his calf. It was less than 3 weeks to Christmas. Every afternoon after school and all day Saturday, he was either in the square or where he could see it, watch it. It was cold for another day or two. Then it got warm. The wind softened, then the bright sun hazed over and it rained, yet he still walked or stood about the street where the store windows were already filling with toys and Christmas goods and fireworks and colored lights and evergreen and tinsel, or behind the steamy window of the drugstore or barbershop watched the country faces, the two packages. The 4 2-for-a-quarter cigars for Lucas and the tumbler of snuff for his wife, in their bright Christmas paper in his pocket, until at last he saw Edmunds and gave them to him to deliver Christmas morning. But that merely discharged, with doubled interest, the 70 cents. There still remained the dead, monstrous, heatless disc which hung nightly in the black abyss of the rage and impotence. If he would just be a nigger first, just for 1 second, one little infinitesimal second. So in February, he began to save his money. The 25 cents his father gave him each week as allowance, and the 25 cents his uncle paid him as office salary. Until in May he had enough, and with his mother helping him, chose the flowered imitation silk dress and sent it by mail to Molly Beecham, care of Carruthers Edmunds, RFD, and at last he had something like ease, because the rage was gone, and all he could not forget was the grief and the shame. The disc still hung in the black vault, but it was almost a year old now, and so the vault itself was not so black with the disc paling, and he could even sleep under it as even the insomniac dozes at last under his waning and glareless moon. Then it was September. School would begin in another week. He came home one afternoon and his mother was waiting for him. "Here's something for you," she said. It was a gallon bucket of fresh, homemade sorghum molasses, and he knew the answer at once long before she finished speaking. "Somebody from Mr. Edmunds' place sent it to you." "Lucas Beecham," he said, cried almost. "How long has he been gone? Why didn't he wait for me?" "No," his mother said. "He didn't bring it himself. He sent it in. A white boy brought it on a mule." And that was all. They were right back where they had started. It was all to do over again. It was even worse this time, because this time Lucas had commanded a white hand to pick up his money and give it back to him. Then he realized that he couldn't even start over again, because to take the can of molasses back and fling it into Lucas's front door would only be the coins again for Lucas again to command somebody to pick up and return. Not to mention the fact that he would have to ride a Shetland pony, which he had outgrown and was ashamed of, except that his mother wouldn't agree yet to let him have a full-sized horse, or at least the kind of full-sized horse he wanted, and that his uncle had promised him. 17 miles in order to reach the door to fling it through. This would have to be all. Whatever would or could set him free was beyond not merely his reach, but even his ken. He could only wait for it if it came, and do without it if it didn't. And 4 years later he had been free almost 18 months, and he thought it was all. Old Molly dead, and her and Lucas's married daughter moved with her husband to Detroit, and he heard now at last by chance, remote and belated hearsay, that Lucas was living alone in the house, solitary, kinless, and intractable. Apparently not only without friends even in his own race, but proud of it. He had seen him 3 times more, on the square, in town, and not always on Saturday. In fact, it would be a year from the last time before he would realize that he had never seen him in town on Saturday when all the other Negroes, and most of the whites too, from the country came in. Nor even that the occasions when he did see him were almost exactly a year apart, and that the reason he saw him then was not that Lucas's presence had happened to coincide with his own chance passage through the square, but that he had coincided with Lucas's annual and necessary visits. But on weekdays, like the white men who were not farmers but planters, who wore neckties and vests like the merchants and doctors and lawyers themselves, as if he refused, declined to accept even that little of the pattern not only of Negro but of country Negro behavior. And always in the worn, brushed, obviously once expensive black broadcloth suit of the portrait photograph on the gold easel, and the raked fine hat, and the boiled white shirt of his own grandfather's time, and the tieless collar, and the heavy watch chain, and the gold toothpick, like the one his own grandfather had carried in his upper vest pocket. The first time in the second winter. He had spoken first, though Lucas had remembered him at once. He thanked him for the molasses, and Lucas had answered exactly as his grandfather himself might, only the words, the grammar, any different. They turned out good this year. When I was making them, I remembered how a boy's always got a sweet tooth for good molasses. And went on, saying over his shoulder, "Don't fall in no more creeks this winter." And saw him twice more after that. The black suit, the hat, the watch chain, but the next time he didn't have the toothpick, and this time Lucas looked straight at him, straight into his eyes from 5 feet away and past him, and he thought, "He has forgotten me. He doesn't even remember me anymore." Until almost the next year when his uncle told him that Molly, the old wife, had died a year ago. Nor did he bother, take time to wonder then how his uncle, obviously Edmonds had told him, happened to know about it, because he was already counting rapidly backward. He said, thought with a sense of vindication, easement, triumph almost, "She had just died then. That was why he didn't see me. That was why he didn't have the toothpick." Thinking with a kind of amazement, he was grieving. You don't have to not be a nigger in order to grieve. And then he found that he was waiting, haunting the square almost as he had done 2 years ago when he was watching for Edmonds to give him the 2 Christmas presents to deliver. Through the next 2, then 3, then 4 months, before it occurred to him that when he had seen Lucas in town, it had always been only once each year in January or February. And then, for the first time, he realized why. He had come in to pay the yearly taxes on his land. So it was late January, a bright, cold afternoon. He stood on the bank corner in the thin sun and saw Lucas come out of the courthouse and cross the square directly toward him, in the black suit and the tieless shirt and the fine old hat at its swaggering rake, walking so erect that the coat touched him only across the shoulders from which it hung, and he could already see the cocked, slanted glint of the gold toothpick, and he could feel the muscles of his face, waiting. And then Lucas looked up and once more looked straight into his eyes for perhaps a quarter of a minute, and then away, and came straight on, and then even sidestepped a little in order to pass him, and passed him and went on. Nor did he look back either, standing at the curb edge in the thin, cold sun, thinking, "He didn't even fail to remember me this time. He didn't even know me. He hasn't even bothered to forget me." Thinking in a sort of peace, even, "It's over." That was all. Because he was free. The man who for 3 years had obsessed his life, waking and sleeping too, had walked out of it. He would see him again, of course. Without doubt, they would pass on the street in town like this once each year for the rest of Lucas's life, but that would be all. The one, no longer the man, but only the ghost of him who had ordered the 2 Negro boys to pick up his money and give it back to him. The other only the memory of the child who had offered it and then flung it down, carrying into manhood only the fading tag end of that old once frantic shame and anguish and need not for revenge, vengeance, but simply for re-equalization, reaffirmation of his masculinity and his white blood. And someday the one would not even be any longer the ghost of the man who had ordered the coins picked up, and to the other the shame and anguish would no longer be a thing remembered and recallable, but merely a breath, a whisper, like the bitter, sweet, sour taste of the sheep sorrel eaten by the boy in his dead childhood, remembered only in the instant of tasting and forgotten before it could be placed and remembered. He could imagine them as old men meeting, quite old, at some point in that agony of naked inanesthetizable nerve ends, which, for lack of a better word, men call being alive, at which not only their elapsed years, but the half-century of discrepancy between them would be as indistinguishable and uncountable as that many sand grains in a coal pile, and he saying to Lucas, "I was the boy who, when you gave me half of your dinner, tried to pay you with some things which people in those days called 70 cents worth of money, and so all I could think of to save my face was to fling it on the floor. Don't you remember?" And Lucas, "Was that me?" or vice versa, turned around, and it was Lucas saying, "I was the man when you throwed your money on the floor and wouldn't pick it up. I had to have two niggers pick it up and hand it back to you. Don't you remember?" And he this time, "Was that me?" Because it was over now. He had turned the other cheek, and it had been accepted. He was free. Then he came back through the square late that Saturday afternoon. There had been a ball game on the high school field, and he heard that Lucas had killed Vincent Gowrie out at Fraser's store. Word had come for the sheriff about 3 o'clock and had been relayed on by another party line telephone down into the opposite corner of the county, where the sheriff had gone this morning on business and where a messenger might quite possibly find him sometime between now and tomorrow's sunup. Which would make little difference, since even if the sheriff had been in his office, he would probably be too late, since Fraser's store was in Beat 4, and if Yoknapatawpha County was the wrong place for a nigger to shoot a white man in the back, then Beat 4 was the last place, even in Yoknapatawpha County, a nigger with any judgment, or any other stranger of any color, would have chosen to shoot anybody, least of all one named Gowrie, before or behind either. Already the last car full of the young men and some not so young whose business addresses not only on Saturday afternoons, but all week too were the pool hall and the barber shop, and some of whom even had some vague connection with cotton or automobiles or land and stock sales, who bet on prize fights and punch boards and national ball games, had long since left the square to hurry the 15 miles to park along the highway in front of the constable's house, where the constable had taken Lucas, and the story said had handcuffed him to a bedpost and was now sitting over him with a shotgun. And Edmonds, too, of course, by now. Even a fool country constable would have had sense enough to send for Edmonds only 4 miles away, even before hollering for the sheriff, in case the Gowries and their connections decided not to wait until they had buried Vincent first. Of course Edmonds would be there. If Edmonds had been in town today, he would certainly have seen him at some time during the morning and before he went to the ballpark, and since he had not, obviously Edmonds had been at home, only 4 miles away. A messenger could have reached him, and Edmonds himself could have been at the constable's house almost before the other messenger had memorized the sheriff's telephone and the message to give him, and then rode to the nearest telephone where he could use either. Which, Edmonds... Again, something nagged for a second's flash at his attention, and the constable would be two, while the Lord himself would have to stop to count the Gowries and Ingrams and Workits, and if Edmonds was busy eating supper or reading the paper or counting his money or something, the constable would be just one, even with the shotgun. But then he was free, hardly even pausing really, walking on to the corner where he would turn for home, and not until he saw how much of sun, how much was left of afternoon still in the street, then turn back, retracing his steps for several yards before he remembered why in the world he didn't cut straight across the now almost empty square to the outside stairs leading up to the office. Though, of course, there was really no reason to expect his uncle to be in the office this late on Saturday afternoon. But once on the stairs, he could at least throw that away. Happening to be wearing rubber soles today, though even then the wooden stairs creaked and rumbled unless you trod the inside edge close to the wall. Thinking how he had never really appreciated rubber soles before. How nothing could match them for giving you time to make up your mind what you really wanted to do. And then he could see the office door closed now, although it was still too early for his uncle to have had the lights on, but besides, the door itself had that look which only locked doors have, so even hard soles wouldn't have mattered. Unlocking the door with his key, then locking it with the thumb latch behind him, and crossed to the heavy swivel roller chair which had been his grandfather's before his uncle's, and sat down behind the littered table which his uncle used in place of the roll-top desk of his grandfather's old time, and across which the county's legal business had passed longer than he could remember, since, in fact, his memory was memory, or anyway his. And so battered table and dog-eared faded papers and the needs and passions they represented and the measured and bounded county too were all coeval and one. The last of the sun coming through the mulberry tree, then the window behind him, onto the table, the stacked untidy papers, the inkwell, the tray of paper clips and fouled rusted pen points and pipe cleaners and the overturned corn cob pipe in its spill of ash beside the stained, unwashed coffee cup and saucer and the colored mug from the Heidelberg Stube filled with twisted spills of newspaper to light the pipes with like the vase sitting on Lucas's mantle that day and before he even knew he had thought of it, he rose taking up the cup and saucer and crossed the room picking up the coffee pot and the kettle too in passing. And in the lavatory emptied the grounds and rinsed the pot and cup and filled the kettle and set it and the pot, the cup and saucer back on the shelf and returned to the chair and sat down again after really no absence at all, still in plenty of time to watch the table and all its familiar untidy clutter all fading toward one anonymity of night as the sunlight died. Thinking, remembering how his uncle had said that all man had was time. All that stood between him and the death he feared and abhorred was time, yet he spent half of it inventing ways of getting the other half past. And suddenly he remembered from nowhere what it was that had been nagging at his attention. Edmonds was not at home, nor even in Mississippi. He was in a hospital in New Orleans being operated on for gallstones, the heavy chair making a rumbling clatter on the wooden floor almost as loud as a wagon on a wooden bridge as he rose and then stood beside the table until the echo died away and there was only the sound of his breathing. Because he was free. And then he moved. Because his mother would know what time baseball games finished, even if she couldn't have heard the yelling from across the edge of town, and she would know that even he could use up only so much of twilight getting home. Locking the door behind him, then down the stairs again, the square filled with dusk now, and the first lights coming on in the drugstore. They had never been off in the barber shop and the pool hall since the boot black and the porter unlocked the doors and swept out the hair and cigarette stubs at 6 o'clock this morning. And the mercantile ones, too, so that the rest of the county except Beat 4 would have somewhere to wait until word could come in from Fraser's store that all was okey-doke again and they could unpark the trucks and cars and wagons and mules from the back streets and alleys and go home and go to bed. Turning the corner this time, and now the jail, looming, lightless except for the one cross-barred rectangle in the upper front wall where on ordinary nights the nigger crapshooters and whiskey peddlers and razor throwers would be yelling down to their girls and women on the street below, and where Lucas would have been these 3 hours now, very likely banging on the steel door for somebody to bring him his supper, or perhaps having already had it and now merely to complain about its quality, since without doubt he would consider that his right too, along with the rest of his lodging and keep. Except that people seemed to hold that the one sole end of the entire establishment of public office was to elect one man like Sheriff Hampton, big enough, or at least with sense and character enough, to run the county, and then fill the rest of the jobs with cousins and in-laws who would fail to make a living at everything else they ever tried. But then he was free, and besides, it was probably all over by now, and even if it wasn't, he knew what he was going to do, and there was plenty of time yet for that. Tomorrow would be time enough for that. All he would need to do tonight was to give Highboy about 2 extra cups of oats against tomorrow, and at first he believed he was, or at least in a moment, was going to be ravenously hungry himself. Sitting down at the familiar table in the familiar room among the bright linen and silver and the water glasses and the bowl of narcissus and gladioli and a few roses in it too, and his uncle said, "Your friend Beecham seems to have done it this time." "Yes," he said. "They're going to make a nigger out of him once in his life anyway." "Charles," his mother said, eating rapidly. Eating quite a lot, and talking rapidly, and quite a lot, too, about the ball game, and waiting to get hungry any minute, any second now, until suddenly he knew that even the last bite had been too much, still chewing at it to get it down to where it would swallow, already getting up. "I'm going to the picture show," he said. "You haven't finished," his mother said. Then she said, "The show doesn't begin for almost an hour yet." And then not even just to his father and uncle, but to all time, all A.D. of our Lord 1930 and 40 and 50, "I don't want him to go to town tonight. I don't want..." And then at last one wail, one cry to the Supreme, his father himself, out of that night-traddled dragon region of fears and terrors in which women, mothers anyway, seemed from choice almost to dwell. "Charlie?" Until his uncle put his napkin down and rose too and said, "Then here's your chance to wean him. I want him to do an errand for me anyway." And out, on the front gallery in the dark, cool, and after a while his uncle said, "Well, go on." "Ain't you coming?" he said. Then he said, "But why? Why?" "Does that matter?" his uncle said, and then said what he had already heard when he passed the barber shop going on 2 hours ago now. "Not now. Not to Lucas nor anybody else of his color out there." But he had already thought of that himself, not just before his uncle said it, but even before whoever it had been in front of the barbershop 2 hours ago did. And for that matter, the rest of it, too. In fact, the true why is not what crisis he faced beyond which life would be no longer bearable until he shot a white man in the back, but why, of all white men, he must pick a gowrie to shoot and out of all possible places beat 4 to do it in. "Go on, but don't be late. After all, a man ought to be kind even to his parents now and then." And sure enough, one of the cars, and for all he knew, maybe all of them had got back to the barber shop and the pool hall, so apparently Lucas was still chained and peaceful to the bedpost, and the constable sitting over him. It was probably a rocking chair. With the cold shotgun, and probably the constable's wife had served their supper there, and Lucas, with a good appetite, sharp set for his, since he not only wouldn't have to pay for it, but you don't shoot somebody every day in the week. And at last it seemed to be more or less authentic that the sheriff had finally got the word and sent word back that he would return to town late tonight and would fetch Lucas in early tomorrow morning. And he would have to do something. Pass the time somehow until the picture show was out, so he might as well go to it. And he crossed the square to the courthouse yard and sat down on a bench in the dark, cool, empty solitude among the bitten shadows, the restless, unwindy vernal leaves against the starry s'more of heaven, where he could watch the lighted marquee in front of the picture show, and perhaps the sheriff was right. He seemed able to establish enough contact with Gowries and Ingrams and Workitts and McCallums to persuade them to vote for him every 8 years, so maybe he knew approximately what they would do under given situations. Or perhaps the people in the barber shop were right, and the Ingrams and Gowries and Workitts were waiting not until they had buried Vincent tomorrow, but simply because it would be Sunday in 3 hours now, and they didn't want to have to hurry. Bolt through the business in order to finish it by midnight and not violate the Sabbath. Then the first of the crowd dribbled, then flowed beneath the marquee, blinking into the light, and even fumbling a little for a second or even a minute or two yet, bringing back into the shabby earth a fading remnant of the heart's celluloid and daring dream, so he could go home now. In fact, he would have to. Who knew by simple instinct when picture shows were over, just as she did when ball games were, and though she would never really forgive him for being able to button his own buttons and wash behind his ears, at least she accepted it and would not come after him herself, but merely send his father. And by starting now ahead of the picture show's dispersal, he would have the empty street until he got home. Until he reached the corner of the yard, in fact, and his uncle stepped out from beside the hedge, hatless, smoking one of the cob pipes. "Listen," his uncle said. "I talked to Hampton down at Peddler's Field, Old Town, and he had already telephoned Squire Fraser, and Fraser himself went to Skipworth's house and saw Lucas handcuffed to the bedpost, and it's all right. Everything's quiet out there tonight, and tomorrow morning Hampton will have Lucas locked up in the jail." "I know," he said. "They won't lynch him until after midnight tomorrow night, after they have buried Vincent and got rid of Sunday." Walking on. "It's all right with me. Lucas didn't have to work this hard not to be a nigger just on my account. Because he was free, in bed. In the cool, familiar room, in the cool, familiar dark, because he knew what he was going to do. And he had forgotten, after all, to tell Alexander to give High Boy the extra feed against tomorrow, but in the morning would do just as well, because he was going to sleep tonight, because he had something about 10,000 times quicker than just sheep to count. In fact, he was going to go to sleep so fast he probably wouldn't have time to count more than about 10 of them. With rage, an almost unbearable excruciation of outrage and fury. Any white man to shoot in the back but this one, of all white men at all. Youngest of a family of 6 brothers, one of whom had already served a year in federal penitentiary for armed resistance as an army deserter, and another term at the state penal farm for making whiskey, and a ramification of cousins and in-laws covering a whole corner of the county, and whose total number probably even the old grandmothers and maiden aunts couldn't have stated offhand. A connection of brawlers and farmers and fox hunters and stock and timber traders, who would not even be the last anywhere to let one of its number be killed by anyone, but only among the last, since it in its turn was integrated and interlocked and intermarried with other brawlers and fox hunters and whiskey makers, not even into a simple clan or tribe, but a race. A species which before now had made their hill stronghold good against the county and the federal government too, which did not even simply inhabit, nor had merely corrupted, but had translated and transmogrified that whole region of lonely pine hills, dotted meagerly with small tilted farms and peripatetic sawmills and contraband whiskey kettles where peace officers from town didn't even go unless they were sent for, and strange white men didn't wander far from the highway after dark, and no Negro at any time. Whereas a local wit said once the only stranger ever to enter with impunity was God, and he only by daylight and on Sunday, into a synonym for independence and violence, an idea with physical boundaries like a quarantine for plague, so that solitary, unique, and alone out of all the county, it was known to the rest of the county by the number of its survey coordinate, beat 4. As in the middle 20s, people knew where Cicero, Illinois was, and who lived there and what they did, who neither knew nor cared what state Chicago was in. And since this was not enough, choosing the one moment when the one man, white or black, Edmonds, out of all Yaknapatawpha County or Mississippi or America or the world, too, for that matter, who would have had any inclination, let alone power and ability, and here he had to laugh, even though he was just about to go to sleep, remembering how he had even thought at first that if Edmonds had been at home, it would have made any difference anywhere. Remembering the face, the angle of the hat, the figure straddled, baronial as a duke or a squire or a congressman before the fire, hands clasped behind it and not even looking down at them, but just commanding 2 nigger boys to pick up the coins and give them back to him. Not even needing to remember his uncle reminding him ever since he had got big enough to understand the words, that no man could come between another man and his destiny, because even his uncle, for all Harvard and Heidelberg, couldn't have pointed out the man with enough temerity and delusion just to come between Lucas and merely what he wanted to do. To try to stand between Lucas and the violent fate he had courted was lying flat on his back in a New Orleans operating room. Yet that was what Lucas had had to pick. That time, that victim, and that place. Another Saturday afternoon, and the same store where he had already had trouble with a white man at least once before. Chose the first suitable, convenient Saturday afternoon, and with an old single-action Colt pistol of a caliber and type not even made anymore, which was exactly the sort of pistol Lucas would own. Exactly as no other still alive man in the county owned a gold toothpick lay in wait at the store. The one sure place where sooner or later on Saturday afternoon that whole end of the county would pass. Until the victim appeared and shot him. And nobody knew why yet, and as far as he had discovered that afternoon, or even when he finally left the square that night, nobody had even wondered yet, since why didn't matter. Least of all to Lucas, since apparently he had been working for 20 or 25 years with indefatigable and unflagging concentration toward this one crowning moment. Followed him into the woods about 1 good spit from the store and shot him in the back within hearing distance of the crowd around it, and was still standing over the body. The fired pistol put neatly away into his hip pocket again when the first ones reached the scene, where he would without doubt have been lynched immediately out of hand except for the same Doyle Fraser who had saved him from the single tree 7 years ago, and old Skipworth, the constable. A little dried-up, wizened, stone-deaf old man, not much larger than a half-grown boy, with a big nickel-plated pistol loose in one coat pocket, and in the other a gutta-percha ear trumpet on a rawhide thong around his neck like a foxhorn, who on this occasion anyway revealed an almost gratuitous hardihood and courage, getting Lucas, who made no resistance whatever, merely watching this, too, with that same calm, detached, not even scornful interest, out of the crowd, and took him to his home and chained him to the bedpost until the sheriff could come and get him and bring him into town and keep him while the Gowries and Workitts and Ingrams and the rest of their guests and connections could get Vincent buried and Sunday passed and so be fresh and untrammeled for the new week and its duties and, believe it or not, even the night passed, the tentative roosters at false dawn, then the interval, then the loud, fairy clangor of the birds, and through the east window he could see the trees against gray light, and then the sun itself, high and furious above the trees, glaring at him. And it was already late. This, of course, must happen to him, too. But then he was free, and he would feel better after breakfast, and he could always say he was going to Sunday school, but then he wouldn't have to say anything by going out the back, strolling, across the backyard and into the lot and across it and through the woods to the railroad, to the depot, and then back to the square. Then he thought of a simpler way than that, and then quit thinking about it at all. Through the front hall and across the front gallery and down the walk to the street. And it was here he would remember later having first noticed that he had seen no Negro except Paralee when she brought his breakfast. By ordinary, at this hour on Sunday morning, he would have seen on almost every gallery housemaids or cooks in their fresh Sunday aprons with brooms or perhaps talking from gallery to gallery across the contiguous yard spaces. And the children, too fresh and scrubbed for Sunday school with clutched, palm-sweaty nickels, though perhaps it was a little too early for that, or perhaps by mutual consent or even interdiction, there would be no Sunday school today, only church. And so at some mutual, concorded moment, say about 11:30, all the air over Yoknapatawpha County would reverberate soundlessly, like heat shimmer, with one concerted adjuration, calm the hearts of these bereaved and angry men. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Thou shalt not kill, except that this was a little late, too. They should have mentioned this to Lucas yesterday. Past the jail, the barred second-story window whose interstices on an ordinary Sunday would have been thick with dark hands, and beyond them even a glint now and then of eye whites in the shadows and the mellow voices calling and laughing down to the Negro girls and women passing or stopping along the street. And this was when he realized that except for Paralee, he had seen no Negro since yesterday afternoon, though it would be tomorrow before he would learn that the ones who lived in the Hollow and Freedmantown hadn't come to work at all since Saturday night. Nor on the square either, not even in the barber shop, where Sunday morning was the bootblack's best day, shining shoes and brushing clothes and running errands and drawing baths for the bachelor truck drivers and garage hands who lived in rented rooms, and the young men and the ones not so young who worked hard all week in the pool hall. And the sheriff really had finally got back to town and had even torn himself away from his Sunday to go for Lucas. Listening, hearing the talk, a dozen of them who had hurried out to Fraser's store yesterday afternoon and returned empty-handed, and he gathered one carful, had even gone back last night, yawning and lounging now and complaining of lack of sleep, and that to be added to Lucas's account, too. And he had heard all this before, too, and had even thought of it himself before that. I wonder if Hampton took a shovel with him. That's all he's going to need. They'll lend him a shovel out there. Yes, if there's anything to bury. They have gasoline even in Beat 4. I thought old Skipworth was going to take care of that. Sure, but that's Beat 4. They'll do what Skipworth tells them as long as he's got the nigger. But he's going to turn him over to Hampton. That's when it'll happen. Hope Hampton might be sheriff in Yoknapatawpha County, but he's just another man in Beat 4. No, they won't do nothing today. They're burying Vincent this afternoon, and to burn a nigger right while the funeral's going on wouldn't be respectful to Vincent. That's so. It'll probably be tonight. On Sunday night? Is that the gallery's fault? Lucas ought to thought of that before he picked out Saturday to kill Vincent on. I don't know about that. Hope Hampton's gonna be a hard man to take a prisoner away from, too. A nigger murderer? Who in this county or state either is gonna help him protect a nigger that shoots white men in the back? Or the South, either. Yes, or the South, either. He had heard it all before. Outside again now. Only his uncle might decide to come to town before time to go for the noon mail at the post office, and if his uncle didn't see him, then he really could tell his mother he didn't know where he was, and of course he thought first of the empty office, but if he went there, that's exactly where his uncle would come to. Because, and he remembered again that he had forgot to give Highboy the extra feed this morning, too, but it was too late now, and besides, he was going to carry feed with him anyway. He knew exactly what he was going to do. The sheriff had left town about 9 o'clock. The constable's house was 15 miles away on a gravel road, not too good, but the sheriff should certainly go there and be back with Lucas by noon, even if he stopped to make a few votes while there. Long before that time, he would go home and saddle Highboy and tie a sack of feed behind the saddle and turn him in a straight line in the opposite direction from Fraser's store and ride in that one undeviable direction for 12 hours, which would be about midnight tonight, and feed Highboy and rest him until daylight or even longer if he decided to, and then ride the 12 hours back, which would be 18, actually, or maybe even 24, or even 36. But at least all over, finished, done. No more fury and outrage to have to lie in bed with, like trying to put yourself to sleep counting sheep. And he turned the corner and went along the opposite side of the street, and under the shed in front of the closed blacksmith shop. The heavy double wooden doors not locked with a hasp or latch, but with a padlocked chain passed through an auger hole in each one so that the slack of the chain created an insag almost like an alcove. Standing in it, nobody could have seen him from either up the street or down it, nor even passing along it, which would not be his mother anyway today, unless they stopped to look. And now the bells began ringing in mellow, unhurried, discordant strophe and antistrophe from steeple to pigeon-swirled steeple across the town. Streets and square, one sudden, decorous flow of men in their dark suits and women in silks and parasols and girls and young men two and two, flowing and decorous beneath that mellow uproar into that musical clamor. Gone. Square and street empty again, though still the bells rang on for a while yet. Sky dwellers, groundless denizens of the topless air, too high, too far insentient to the crawling earth, then ceasing, stroke by hasteless stroke, from the subterrene shudder of organs and the cool, frantic monotone of the settled pigeons. 2 years ago, his uncle had told him that there was nothing wrong with cursing. On the contrary, it was not only useful but substituteless. But like everything else valuable, it was precious only because the supply was limited, and if you wasted it on nothing, on its urgent need, you might find yourself bankrupt. So he said, "What the hell am I doing here?" Then answered himself the obvious answer. Not to see Lucas. He had seen Lucas, but so that Lucas could see him again if he so wished. To look back at him not just from the edge of mere uniqueless death, but from the gasoline roar of apotheosis. Because he was free. Lucas was no longer his responsibility. He was no longer Lucas's keeper. Lucas himself had discharged him. Then suddenly the empty street was full of men. Yet there were not many of them, not 24, some suddenly and quietly from nowhere. Yet they seemed to fill it, block it, render it suddenly interdict, as though not that nobody could pass them, pass through it, use it as a street, but that nobody would dare, would even approach near enough to essay the gambit as people stay well away from a sign saying high voltage or explosive. He knew, recognized them all. Some of them he had even seen and listened to in the barber shop 2 hours ago. The young men, or men under 40, bachelors, the homeless who had the Saturday and Sunday baths in the barber shop, truck drivers and garage hands, the oiler from the cotton gin, a soda jerker from the drugstore, and the ones who could be seen all week long in or around the pool hall, who did nothing at all that anyone knew, who owned automobiles and spent money nobody really knew exactly how they earned on weekends in Memphis or New Orleans brothels. The men who his uncle said were in every little southern town, who never really led mobs nor even instigated them, but were always the nucleus of them because of their mass availability. Then he saw the car. He recognized it, too, even in the distance, without knowing, or for that matter, stopping to wonder how, himself moving out of his concealing doorway into the street and then across it to the edge of the crowd, which made no sound but just stood there, blocking the sidewalk beside the jail fence and overflowing into the street while the car came up, not fast, but quite deliberately. Almost decorously, as a car should move on Sunday morning, and drew into the curb in front of the jail and stopped. A deputy was driving it. He made no move to get out. Then the rear door opened and the sheriff emerged. A big, tremendous man with no fat and little, hard, pale eyes in a cold, almost bland, pleasant face, who, without even glancing at them, turned and held the door open. Then Lucas got out, slowly and stiffly, exactly like a man who has spent the night chained to a bedpost, fumbling a little and bumping, or at least raking his head against the top of the door, so that as he emerged, his crushed hat tumbled from his head onto the pavement almost under his feet. And that was the first time he had ever seen Lucas without the hat on, and in the same second he realized that, with the possible exception of Edmonds, they there in the street watching him were probably the only white people in the county who had ever seen him uncovered. Watching as, still bent over as he had emerged from the car, Lucas began to reach stiffly for the hat. But already in one vast yet astonishingly supple stoop, the sheriff had picked it up and handed it back to Lucas, who still bent over, seemed to fumble at the hat too. Yet almost at once the hat was creased back into its old shape, and now Lucas was standing up, erect except for his head. His face, as he brushed the hat back and forth against the sleeve of his forearm, rapid and light and deft as you stroke a razor. Then his head. His face went back and up, too, and in a motion not quite sweeping, he set the hat back on his head at the old angle which the hat itself seemed to assume, as if he had flung it up, and erect now in the black suit, crumpled, too, from whatever night he had spent. There was a long, grimed smear down one entire side from shoulder to ankle, as if he had been lying on an unswept floor a long time in one position without being able to change it. Lucas looked at them for the first time, and he thought, "Now, he will see me now." And then he thought, "He saw me, and that's all." And then he thought, "He hasn't seen anybody." Because the face was not even looking at them, but just toward them, arrogant and calm and with no more defiance in it than fear. Detached, impersonal, almost musing, intractable and composed, the eyes blinking a little in the sunlight even after the sound. An indraw of breath went up from somewhere in the crowd, and a single voice said, "Knock it off again, Hope! Take his head, too, this time!" "You boys get out of here," the sheriff said. "Go back to the barber shop." Turning, saying to Lucas, "All right, come on." And that was all. the face for another moment looking not at them, but just toward them, the sheriff already walking toward the jail door when Lucas turned at last to follow him, and by hurrying a little he could even get Highboy saddled and be out of the lot before his mother began to send Alexander to look for him to come and eat dinner. Then he saw Lucas stop and turn, and he was wrong, because Lucas even knew where he was in the crowd before he turned, looking straight at him before he got turned around even, speaking to him. "You, young man," Lucas said, "tell your uncle I wants to see him." Then turned again and walked on after the sheriff, still a little stiffly in the smeared black suit, the hat arrogant and pale in the sunlight, the voice in the crowd saying, "Lawyer, hell! He won't even need an undertaker when them Gowries get through with him tonight." Walking on past the sheriff, who himself had stopped now and was looking back at them, saying in his mild, cold, bland, heatless voice, "I told you folks once to get out of here. I ain't going to tell you again."